Hey everyone, this is Melissa, and I'm the talkative introvert. Welcome back to the podcast. If you're new here, thanks so much for checking out the pod. I hope you enjoyed today's episode and decide to keep listening. If you do, please spread the word, share it with your friends and family, and rate and review the podcast. So for today's episode, I am joined by Jay Schiffman. He founded the company Choose Your Struggle in 2015 with two distinct goals: ending stigma and promoting honest and fact-based education around the topics of mental health, substance misuse and recovery, and drug use and policy. A fervent believer in radical honesty and the simple fact that neither struggle nor recovery should be treated as a one-size-fits-all experience, Jay uses his voice and his platform to educate, entertain, and empower. So thank you so much for joining me today.
It's great to be here, and I do appreciate, you know, I a couple years ago had someone, a person who does this work professionally, write me a full bio. And I always send it to people and say, please, for the love of God, do not read this whole thing. Take something out of it, right? And they always, without fail, end up reading this like 9-paragraph thing. So I really appreciate that you were able to distill my bio down to like 3 sentences. That's perfect. I'm going to have to steal that and use it going forward.
Yeah, I saw your bio. I was like, no, I'm not reading all this.
You shouldn't. Please do not. No.
Yeah, I've heard other podcasts too that do the same. They just read out the whole page. I was like, no, just something quick and sweet. You know, Like don't have to go like way into it.
Yes. Well, you did it perfectly.
Thank you. Appreciate it. So for the podcast, you know, I am the talkative introvert. So I do like to ask my guests, you know, are you an introvert, extrovert, or somewhere in the middle, an ambivert?
I would say that I am pretty far down the spectrum towards extrovert. However, you know, it's funny when you are as far down that spectrum on that side mm-hmm. as I am, when you are not being extroverted, the people in your life think there's something terribly wrong. And so I like to always say that just because I am, let's say, even like an 85 or 90 on that spectrum, it's not 100. And so there are times we go out, you know, my wife and I are friends mm-hmm. and I'll be quiet and within 5 minutes, someone will go, are you okay? Like, what's going on with you? And I'm like, I'm in my 10% zone right now. I just need some time to be introverted. But I am normally pretty far down towards the extroversion scale.
Okay. Have you ever taken like an MBTI or like a, you have? Okay.
Yeah, it's been a while. I couldn't tell you my results. As a guy who was a psych major in college and now works in this field, I've taken every one of those assessments because, you know, one time or another, it was the hip thing to do was to know your whatever. I like those a lot. I think they're really interesting. They give you a lot to think about, a lot to work with. And then at the end of the day, I like to tell people I'm just Jay. I'm like Tigger. Yeah. There's only one of me. So, I love those tests, but I could not tell you a single one of my results.
Yeah, I think they're fun to take, but I do know like people change and maybe you're one thing 1 year, but then, you know, something changes and you end up being something else the next year. So, right. But I do think they're a lot of fun. But yeah, when I took it, I think I got like 93% introverted. So I'm like the complete opposite of you, but doesn't mean we can't have a great conversation.
No, and it actually means that we probably would have wonderful conversations because, you know, the whole old adage of opposites attract, what you're missing there is that it's not that, I mean, maybe they do, but it's that they complement each other, right? I mean, if both people in a, like, I've got a good friend of mine who is, I mean, if she's not 100 on that scale, like, she's at 99.9, and her partner is, I've maybe in the now 2 years I've known him, heard him say 10 words, and he's just the opposite. and they work so well together because of that, right? And it's less about the attraction. It's more about the complementary aspect of those two people going together. So I would say that I think that means we're going to have a great conversation.
Yeah, I completely agree. All right. So I did reach out to you because on your profile picture, you wore a shirt that said "End the War on Drugs." And I immediately, yep, he's wearing it today. Immediately I was like, I have to get this guy on. Like, I don't know anyone that talks about it. None of my friends really talk about it, you know, other than my husband, but I see my husband like all the time. So like, I need to talk to someone else about it. So like, I had to get you on, but I kind of wanted to talk a little bit about you and, you know, the company that you started first, because I thought, you know, choose your struggle. That's really interesting. Like, you know, so I wanted to know, like, what's the story behind that? Why did you start the company?
Well, the two go hand in hand, and I could talk about the war on drugs and why it's important that we end it all day, every day. It is my, you know, I would say it's my chosen topic. The other things I talk about, mental health and sort of addiction big picture, were in a way thrust upon me from life experience. The war on drugs is really the thing I've spent the last, you know, 3, 4, 5 years educating myself on and really care about deeply. It's what I gave a TED talk about last year. It is one of my favorite topics because I think there's a lot in there that people, number one, don't know. And number two, don't know that they were taught both unintentionally and intentionally the opposite about. I mean, flat out lies. And we can get into all of that later. The company Choose Your Struggle is tied into that because I am a guy in long-term recovery to over 12 years now. And that is a recovery from some, I still wrestle with issues of mental health, but from a really, let's say, hyper period of a struggle of mental health that was tied into a struggling with addiction. And the actual sort of etymology of the Choose Your Struggle, where this comes from, is that I was born into immense privilege. I'm not only as a white dude in a world, especially a country that puts that on top of a mountain, but also a guy who was born into a very stable household with both parents in the home and enough means that we never had to worry about where our next meal was going to come from, whether we were going to have a roof over our head, these basic building blocks of life. And so because of that, I was born into a situation where I got to choose what I was going to struggle for. And what I mean by that is I got to get up every day and say, what is going to be my struggle today? Because the basic need for survival was not my struggle. Fast forward 21, 22 years, and I am struggling with addiction, struggling with my mental health as a result. And I have lost that privilege of that choice. My struggle is thrust upon me. It's to avoid withdrawal. It's to get out of bed every day. It's to you know, try to be healthy and try to just be a person. Those were my struggles. And then I got into recovery, and once again, about 5 years in, when I'm feeling healthy, it took me 5 years in recovery to really get healthy, to have my mental health, my physical health, my maturity, my age, all kind of catch up with each other. And it wasn't long after that I realized that what I had regained was that privilege of choice, that the privilege to actually once again go, what am I going to struggle for? And very clearly, I have chosen those topics that I care so deeply about. But what I've tried to do with Choose Your Struggle is help people understand that, you know, even though some of us have the choice at sort of the biggest level, our lives are never going to be about having that choice made for us, right? I mean, most of us, or many of us, I should say, get that privilege of we don't have to worry about our next meal. We don't have to worry about a roof over our head. And so because of that, we get to make choices. All the way down to the people who unfortunately have those choices taken away, there are still, even if it's 0.001%, there's still a tiny little choice that they can make. And so what Choose Your Struggle literally means is recognizing where in your life you get that privilege of choice.
That's so interesting, because I was just thinking, I was talking to a friend about how sometimes I get tired of people talk, like, I don't know if you did this in your high school, but like, we used to get like motivational speakers who would come in and like talk about, like, you know, you just gotta work hard and find what you're passionate about, and then you'll have your dream job. And I remember talking to my friend about, like, you know, getting the dream job or like having or getting to work and do something you're passionate about is a privilege. You know, like, I didn't grow up with a lot of money, and I didn't you know, it was a struggle when we were younger. And I'm like, you know, some people don't get to do that. Some people don't have the time or the money to go chase their passion, and they have to, like, you know, live within their means, get a job so they can, like, take care of their kids and their family. And so I like that you mentioned that, you know, the privilege of choice, because that is an interesting term.
You know, I'm glad that resonated. I use that a lot. I do not care. I do some interviews that are with people who hate that word privilege. And I was on an interview a little while ago, and the host literally stopped me in the middle of that and was like, you know, I need to stop you. That is a word you shouldn't use. That makes it sound like you didn't work hard and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, look, it's your show. You know, I'll say whatever, you know, you want me to say to an extent, but I don't think there's anything wrong with recognizing that I had the privilege and didn't have to work for a lot of this, right? In fact, I think I need to do that. As a person who was born of immense means, I, quite frankly, I didn't have to work. I don't know what you're thinking right now. Where did I work, right? I mean, I was born into that, and have I had to work? Of course. And I also talk about that, you know, just because I was born into this doesn't mean my life has been, you know, of decadence and easy street. I mean, I've had to work as well, but I'm not going to lie and say that I came out the womb struggling and fighting. Like, that's not my story. Why would I lie like that? And so it really bothers me when people, well, you should take back that power. Man, come on, get out of here with that BS. We all need to recognize where we have privilege in our lives, whether it's people like me who have it just flowing around us, or all the way down to, you know, the people, like I said, who, yes, your life might be a struggle, but there's also the privilege of you have a roof over your head right now, and two, just grossly in this country, there are so many people who don't, right? And we all should recognize where that even iota of privilege that we have in our lives comes from, because you can't build on it if you are unwilling to put a microscope on that and at least acknowledge that at the beginning.
Yeah, exactly. I understand that privilege kind of, especially now, I guess, it's kind of a trigger word for some people. And I get that. I understand that. But, you know, in reality, like you're saying, everyone has some type of privilege, you know, even if it's really little. Like I have the privilege of living here in America and not, you know, being raised in the Philippines, where it's a third world country and everyone struggles. So I think people just put too much emotion into certain words sometimes.
I'm with you. But it's funny, though. I agree with you in there. And then a lot of the work I do is helping educate people how to talk about drug use and addiction. So it is a tightrope to walk, because as you said in my bio, you know, I use the word substance misuse, and we're changing to that away from substance abuse, which is a word born of stigma from the war on drugs. And so it is funny that I spend so much time thinking that, okay, well, your BS baggage with the word privilege or whatever, it's ridiculous. And then here I am going, but please recognize the words that I think are important, you know?
Yeah. So let's talk about that. What is the difference of substance abuse and substance misuse?
So substance abuse comes from an era of the war on drugs that is pretty gross. So it was a word, it was a phrase made up to intentionally stigmatize those who struggle with what we call substance abuse. Where it comes from is, until relatively recently, you know, we're talking 50 or so years ago, 60 years ago, it was honestly believed by the powers that be that white people, they wouldn't say white, they would say, you know, use cultured people or all these other sort of words to cover for saying white people, could not struggle with addiction. This was believed in society because addiction was seen as a moral failing. It was believed to be an uncultured struggle, right? And so there was no worry about how you talked about people with addiction. And they even separated, right? I mean, there are stories of wealthy people struggling. I mean, look at Judy Garland, right? I mean, so famously struggled with addiction. But they had ways to explain this away in the medical field. The only people who actually were diagnosed with what we now call addiction were those that were in the classes of people that the United States mostly sees as undesirable. So, you know, when you look at where a lot of our thinking on drugs comes from, it comes from that. You know, the way we look at addiction today, the way we look at drug use today, is all founded in the original belief dating to the late 1800s through the early 1900s that white people use drugs differently than pretty much everybody else in this country. And unfortunately, because of the U.S.'s outsized influence on the rest of the world, this is the predominant view of drug use and addiction world over. So getting back to the original question, why we're trying to get away from substance abuse. When you think of the word abuse in the other ways we use it in our culture, you think of some of the most heinous acts that are committed every day. You know, spousal abuse, right? That's one of the worst things you can do in your life. And then you think of substance abuse, and it sticks out like a sore thumb. It has nothing to do with all the other forms of quote unquote abuse that we have in our society. And even at a sort of verbiage level, it doesn't make sense. The substance itself, there's no abuse going on. You know, as I always used to joke, when I was struggling with my addiction to pills, the pills were not forcing themselves upon me, right? I mean, there was no abuse in that action. I was choosing them. And I was, in a sense, misusing these substances. So what we're trying to change over to is getting away from substance abuse. And if you're in the medical field, you know, you hear SUD, substance use disorder. That's also something that people don't love because the word disorder has a lot of, you know, negative baggage. But at least it's better than saying substance abuse. And on a day-to-day level, if you want to talk about it, we're now saying substance misuse because it's literally what you were doing, right? The same substance, you know, perfect example. I've never had an issue with alcohol. Last night I had a drink with dinner and wasn't forced to take 10 by my brain the way that I was with prescription pills. I can sit there and drink a beer at a bar, but the guy four bar stools down who's knocking them back, you know, it doesn't. His action is the same as mine, except to an extreme. What's he doing? He's misusing the same substance that I am using in its correct, safe way. There's no violent action being wrapped up in that. There's no abuse. So that's where that terminology change comes from.
Okay. That makes a lot more sense, even just from, you know, just basic English. You are misusing because no one's forcing you to take it.
Right. And the substance themselves are not forcing themselves upon you. There is no force in that,
yeah,
other than from your own body, which is forcing you to misuse a substance that other people are using safely.
Yeah. It's an inanimate object that you have to go out and get.
That's right.
Okay. So I know, so we were touching on war on drugs. So I guess we should probably explain what that is. So for you, you know, this is your topic. So what is the war on drugs?
So the war on drugs was given its name by Richard Nixon in the early 70s. However, it actually dates back to those people who study this now pinpoint the late 1800s as the beginning of the war on drugs in the United States. The first anti-drug law in the U.S. was in California in the late 1800s. And it specifically dealt with a type of opium. It was the type of opium that was smokable, and it was the type preferred by recent Chinese immigrants. Until then, opium is in everything, by the way, at this time. I mean, it's in every drug, and in fact, in many places in the world, it still is a medicinal property. And this may shock some people, but we still use opium variants in our medication. We just don't use the straight opium anymore. However, the only type that was outlawed was the smokable kind. And this was done because of one of the first, or well, the first, drug moral panic in the United States. There was a huge influx of Chinese immigrants being forced to build the railroads and really settle the western part of our country. However, as our society always does when there is a change afoot, people get scared, mostly the white wealthy people. And out of nowhere comes this moral panic that Chinese immigrants are forcing white women into, I mean, you can find everything from sexual slavery down to just misogyny. I mean, it's pretty overt because, again, remember, this is the late 1800s, and the ideas of what racism was back then is pretty, there were no dog whistles. This is out in the open. And so the first drug law is a part of this, and it is specifically outlawing smokable opium. So this starts a domino effect, and you start to see other laws like that continue to fall in around this area. Now, this isn't really happening in other parts of the country because there aren't Chinese immigrants in the amounts that there are in California and other parts of the West at this time. Fast forward to the early 1900s, and you have a new moral panic taking hold, and it is around cannabis. And in fact, this is when the term marijuana is created, originally spelled with an H instead of a J. It is that word is the complete fabrication of the U.S. powers that be, who are trying to associate the immigration from mostly Mexico, but also other parts of Latin America and South America, with this menace that at the time was not seen as any sort of a problem. I mean, the cannabis was not that widespread, but we get the first foreshadowings of politicians recognizing that they can whip up their white base with fear-mongering around other societies' use of drugs, right? They start doing this around cannabis in the 19-teens, and that leads to the first passage of a full anti-drug law in this country in 1914, the Harrison Tax Act, that doesn't outlaw cannabis because, by the way, just like opium, cannabis is in everything. I mean, it is in drinks, it's in a lot of medical treatment, it's all over the place. Hemp was huge. I mean, everybody knows the stories of George Washington growing hemp on his farm. There is belief that some of the first copies of the Declaration of Independence were written on hemp paper. Hemp was everywhere. However, you start to get this fear around Mexican and other Latin American immigrants, and that drives up this moral panic around cannabis. Then you have another, I mean, then the floodgates are open, and what you start to see is similar moral panics on other drugs. Cocaine is next, and cocaine is associated with black people. Here's the craziest thing. This moral panic was sort of a round robin. Southern sharecroppers were giving mostly coca leaves, but cocaine, which again, remember, is also in everything. Coca-Cola literally had cocaine in it, to their sharecroppers to get them to work faster, harder, and then are turning around and helping fan the flames of this moral panic that black men are using cocaine to be impervious to cops' bullets and are then going on rampages and again, you see the same right things that we saw around the Chinese immigrants in the late 1800s, everything from raping white women to, I mean, robbery, all of this kind of stuff. What is just shocking about this is twofold. Number one, it had real world implications at the time. Various laws were passed outlawing not just cocaine, but allowing this should be not shocking to anybody who follows this now, more money to police departments in the South. And you even see police departments in the South, it's like a domino all the way across the country, upgrading their service weapons from I don't know my weapon terminology, but they go up in the caliber because of this stupid non-scientific belief that black men on cocaine could not be brought down with the bullets that were in the guns at the time. And so you get this, the government giving a lot more money to police departments. So that's the first one, is at the time we have these implications. Fast forward forward to today, and the same arguments are being made, right? We saw this with George Floyd. We heard it firsthand when he was murdered, and we all saw the video. The police department's first release was that he did not die from the officer murdering him, that the whole world saw, but he actually died from an overdose of PCP and fentanyl in his system. Obviously, that was flat out false, but police departments know that the magic words are they can say that the person was on drugs, and doesn't matter if they shot him, you know, as we're seeing now 60, 90 times, he was impervious to their bullets, and they couldn't have used the stun gun because that wouldn't bring down a person on PCP. As a person who's used PCP, that doesn't happen. That is not in any way how PCP works. However, not even the average American, 9 out of 10, 99 out of 100 have no knowledge of PCP use. And if the policeman says they couldn't be brought down because they were on PCP, the person goes, yeah, that makes sense. I guess that's what PCP does. So this is why all of this is so important, not just because a lot of our laws when Richard Nixon kicks off the war on drugs in the 70s, and then Ronald Reagan, who, you know, so sorry to anyone listening who doesn't agree with me, is the devil, takes this and runs with it to new heights that are just disgusting in the 80s. That's all super important. Our drug laws, the scheduling of drugs, all of this comes from these ideas that were born on nothing. I mean, completely made up. All of that's crazy important. But what's even more important is the general feeling about people who use drugs and how it allows politicians, police officers to act in such dangerous and disgusting ways by using drugs as a scapegoat is, I think, more important than the actual laws themselves. And that's why we need better education and why the average person needs to know more about the war on drugs so that when they see things like right now where we're having this moral panic around fentanyl, you know, I posted something on Instagram yesterday as we're recording this. There are police departments who are posting on their Facebook pages that, you know, people shouldn't pick up dollar bills off the street because if they do, they might have fentanyl in them and you're going to overdose. Flat out not true. Obvious. First off, just not true. Just from touching it. There okay. is a moral panic right now around fentanyl exposure overdoses. You're seeing these from police stories. There was a 60 Minutes story on this last year about an officer that supposedly overdosed when he was exposed, when he touched a bag of fentanyl. Take it from me, folks. I have literally held fentanyl in my hands, and I'm still here to talk about it. You cannot overdose from touching it. That is not how any of this works. Look, the grain of salt of truth in this is a little bit of fentanyl can cause an overdose. We're seeing a whole lot more overdoses now than we were 10 years ago because of it. That part is true. You cannot overdose without it being in your system. Even if it gets in, you know, you breathe it in or something, there is still plenty of time and ways to avoid an overdose. These videos you're seeing of cops, you know, passing out and stuff like that, what is happening is they're having panic attacks because they all are being taught that this is going to kill them, which is scary. I don't take anything away from that. Panic attacks are very scary. However, they should be getting the help they need for this and not being lied to by their supervisors instead of wasting 10, 20 Narcan doses on somebody who's just having a panic attack. And so it also leads to people avoiding trying to give help to someone who's overdosing because they're scared that what if they have fentanyl on their shirt and then they're going to overdose? That's not how this works. So again, the points I'm trying to make are that you are seeing the repercussions of this today. And people need to know the through lines that go all the way back to the 1800s about how disinformation is allowed to reign when it comes to drug use and drug users.
Yeah. And, you know, in addition to all of that, like I wanted to also add, because from my viewpoint, not only are those issues really, really important and, you know, we're incarcerating people who really shouldn't be in prison or in jail. But on top of all of that stuff, you know, even if we abolish racism and we live in a utopia or whatever, the stigma on drugs it's just, it's important to talk about like how certain drugs are also beneficial to people. You know, we hear about like psychedelics, for example, being used on people with PTSD or depression or anxiety. And right now, like, for example, I know a lot of people, I don't know if you agree, like how your feelings are in the pharmaceutical, you know, big pharma, but you know, traditional medicine, they're just always pushing out pills, pushing out medication because it is money, you know, it's bringing in money. And it bothered me this one time. So my dad passed away a few years ago, and the first thing they did for my mom, because she, if no one's familiar with like FMLA, but you can take like 14 days off of work paid and you have to like justify for that. And so her justification, obviously a spouse died, you know, of course, you know, like you want to take that time off to be with your family and what have you. And for justification, they made her like also go see a doctor and see a psychiatrist. And the first thing he did was like prescribe her an antidepressant. And my mom was like, I'm not depressed. I'm just sad. Like I lost my husband, but I'm not spiraling. I can still get up in the morning, do my day-to-day things. Like I'm just mourning as like a regular person mourns for someone, you know, that passed away. And, you know, a lot of times I feel like traditional medicine likes to do that. They like to push things on people. Like, I did an interview with someone who talks about holistic health, and the whole reason why she started that is because the first thing that, you know, doctors do is just like push pills on you. Like, okay, you're having anxiety, here, take this, or you're having, high blood pressure. I mean, I don't know, just making up, you know, examples. And so that's another thing for me that's important too, is to recognize like, you know, the pharmaceutical companies do want to make money, and we're not recognizing how beneficial like marijuana or cannabis could be, or how beneficial like, you know, psychedelics can be for people. And I know that you talked to I listened to one of your episodes. I forgot her name though, but I really loved that episode. And she, you know, it's all about, you know, psychedelics and how it like helps people. And I was like, yeah, someone's talking about this. Like, you know, it's important to talk about that.
So a couple important points. First off, I'm so sorry for your loss and for your family's loss. Before we get to the psychedelic conversation, it's not surprising that was the move. You know, for people who don't know, there's really three different types of mental health professionals. You have just sort of a blanket therapist slash social worker slash person who's trained in mental health, right, to do therapy work. And then a step up from that is the psychologist, who's really focused on the analyzation and trying different methods of mental health repair. But then next to them, sort of off to the side, is the psychiatrist. And the psychiatrist is only focused on one thing, and that's medication. So a lot of people are referred to psychiatrists by doctors because, I mean, there's a lot of sort of turf wars and all that kind of stuff. But the really the short answer here is that we have broken our medical system to a point where it is about making money first and about helping people second. And unfortunately, the quickest way to help a person, as far as what the insurance would say, is a pill. It's also a measurable outcome. You know, you can say, well, they got this pill that they're going to be on for 30 days. And then when it comes to actual mental health work, it's very open-ended. We don't have a plan of attack the way that we do with physical health, right? You break your leg, you know, okay, this is how long it's going to take. You do this, it's in the cast, and then you do this physical therapy, and then you're good. But we don't have that for mental health. And so insurances really hate mental health care because theoretically they could be paying for this for the next 10 years. They have no idea because that's how mental health works. And unfortunately, which makes this even more gross, is in 2010, as part of Obamacare, the mental health parity was part of the laws that were passed, which means that by law, your insurance is supposed to offer the same level of mental health care as they do physical health care. It has not been held accountable one day. Our brilliant elected leaders have never held our insurance companies accountable to that law. And it's why, if you look at some plans, you could see your doctor physically, once a week, once a month for the entire year, and you're fine, you're covered. But if you go to your mental health care practitioner more than once a month, you're not covered. You're not allowed by your insurance. That's just backwards. That is the opposite of what you need to be doing. A person who is in need of mental health help in that moment, in acute mental health stress, needs once a week, a couple times a week, and yet your insurance are saying, nope, once a month is all you're going to get. So I do put a lot of the issue on the feet of the insurance. However, there is blame to go around for doctors. A lot of the best therapists do not take insurance for that reason. And it's I've talked to therapists who have said, it's just easier for me not to take insurance. And I go, I get it, because that sucks. Our insurance companies are terrible. But then you know that the people who really need your help can't get your help, right? So there's that problem. And then we have elected leaders who frankly just don't care. Who like to use mental health as an excuse. If you don't believe me, look at what everyone says the next time there's a shooting. Oh, it's not a gun problem, it's a mental health problem. Okay, are you going to fund mental health? No, we're not going to do that either. We are going to blame it on mental health, though. So the whole system is broken, and it doesn't surprise me that was what happened with your mom. And I'm very sorry for that. The second half of what we were saying, the psychedelics and all that kind of stuff. What is so horrible about the way our country treats anything that the pharmaceutical companies cannot make money on is that we know cannabis has a lot of incredibly healthful properties in it. This is widely known. And what's even crazier is now in so many states, you have medical marijuana. I myself have a card here in Pennsylvania. However, the U.S. government still has marijuana or cannabis as a Schedule One drug. And what that means, and that goes all the way back to Nixon, what that means is it officially is not recognized as having a single healthy or helpful property in it. And so people who keep pushing for the government to deschedule cannabis, or at least lower it to Schedule Five, where it would be, a lot easier, are saying, look, we know the states are all recognizing this. And the government says, as soon as we have data that shows, this is that there are helpful properties, we will deschedule it. And yet, because it's Schedule One, they don't allow for the testing to be done to show that it actually has helpful properties. And so it is a way for people like our current president, who has a just awful track record on drugs. He wrote the crime bill in the 80s that is one of the most racist laws to pass in the last, my lifetime. And that was the one that originally provided 100 times more consequences for somebody caught with crack cocaine than just regular old snortable cocaine, even though they are literally the same drug. And it was because crack was supposedly preferred by Black people, whereas regular cocaine was preferred by white people, even though studies from that time and since continue to show that that is completely made up, that there was no proof. That was a moral panic at its base. And yet Joe Biden wrote that law. That then while he was vice president under Obama, they brought it down to 18-1 and they celebrated that as if that was like a victory. It was awful. But because of this round robin of mental gymnastics that our government goes through, it allows people like Joe Biden to say that he has no comment on drug laws and that's left up to other people, when in reality, he has the power to change a lot of this. He could, with one stroke of the pen, with an executive order, advanced drug laws and cannabis laws, especially, significantly downfield. And he has the power to release everybody in prison that is there for nonviolent drug offenses, which is just so many people. And yet the way, if you hear him talk about it, it's as if he's powerless, right? So that is why people, I was not a Joe Biden fan from the beginning. I was very disappointed when he came out as the nominee. I think that more people should know about his horrible track records on a lot of things. You know, we like to think of Joe Biden as this kindly old grandpa. Joe Biden is one of the most racist Democrats that has ever been in the party. And he talks about it openly, right? I mean, he is pretty open with his racism. And yet, because of our two-party system, he's seen as the better option. When it's like, I mean, literally, is he better than the devil? Sure. But that's not really a high bar.
Yeah, I was pretty disappointed because I was like, come on. Like, why? There's, well, I am libertarian, so I wasn't happy for either. I'm not into the duopoly at all. I think there are other parties who, you know, would have been better. You know, libertarians are all about ending the war on drugs. That's why I like wanted to talk to you about this. 'Cause I was like,
you know, it's so funny. I'm a registered independent, and what I love about the topic of the war on drugs is it is the only topic that brought George Soros and the Koch brothers to the same table. Those two parties are you know, when people think about extreme right wing and extreme left wing, what do they think about? The Koch brothers, and they think about, you know, the George Soros, right? And yet, in the late 90s, going into the early 2000s, the two of those two groups worked together to try to end the drug war, because they both saw how disastrous this was for very different reasons, you know. But it brought them together, and it in a lot of the changes that have happened since, which obviously were nowhere close to the finish line, were because they were being pushed by major funders from both ends, right? You know, under George Bush, you saw a little bit of this cracking. Under Obama, as we said, we saw a big movement, and it's because both wings, both extreme, you know, sides of this agree on this topic, that the drug war, you know, you can't really call it a failure. It isn't a failure. It's a failure from its stated goals. But the stated goals were never the actual reasons for the war on drugs. Ending drug use was what they, you know, makes you think of Nancy Reagan and Just Say No and all this, but that was never actually what this was about. From the beginning, the war on drugs has been and will always be a war on people that the United States does not see it as worthy of inclusion in our society. As I like to say, those that this community sees as undesirable, and that is namely black and brown people in this country, but also the very poor. It is a way to bring war to these people in the name of ending drug use. And if you don't believe me, we do have one person to thank for that being out in the open, and that is John Ehrlichman. If you've not heard this quote, it is just astounding. I suggest you go look up, go Google John Ehrlichman War on Drugs quote. There was an incredible researcher and journalist by the name of Dan Baum, who sadly passed a couple years ago, and not long before John Ehrlichman died in the 90s. And John Ehrlichman, for those who don't know, was one of Nixon's top advisors, and he went down during Watergate. I mean, he was well known to the country. Ehrlichman sort of has a come to Jesus moment late in his life, and he tells Dan Baum, this drug war on drugs researcher, look, he says, did we know that this was never about the drugs? Of course we did. He said, we knew we couldn't make it illegal to be against the Vietnam War or black. But by associating heroin and cannabis with these communities, we knew that we could terrorize them and arrest them every day on the nightly news, and people would cheer us for it. So what he's saying is, we knew this was a bunch of BS from the beginning, and we did it anyway, right? Ehrlichman was a horrible, horrible human being, but you have to thank him for breaking the silence on that, because it gives people like me the opportunity to say to people, no, this has always been about racism. It has always been about the U.S. wanting to attack its own people. It was never about the drugs. And they knew that was the goal.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm glad he said that. I didn't know that. But it does allow for these conversations to happen, because I think another problem people have too is that people just read headlines. You know, they just trust the news knows what they're doing and that they're, you know, telling you what you should know. But in reality, the news also, they have stakeholders. They have people they need to please. They have to take a side. They got to please, you know, a certain group of people. And also, like, you know, certain things, certain headlines pay. They're clickable. And so, you know, if we really get down to like the nitty gritty, if we expose people, then it really does attack these news outlets, because, you know, they're going to lose funding. They're going to lose money, especially if they're going to go against their biggest shareholder. And so, yeah, I'm glad that person said that. What's his name? John Ehrlichman?
John Ehrlichman. He was one of Nixon's advisors and most famous for his being indicted for Watergate. But in my circle, this quote trumps all of that.
Yeah, that's crazy. Yeah, I'm learning so much from you.
Well, so, okay, let's go with one more name that most people probably don't know. And this is, in my opinion, one of, if not the most sort of underrated villain in the history of the United States. I would love to learn who is worse in terms of people that we've forgotten who had this big of an impact on our society. And his name is Harry Anslinger. Harry Anslinger was the first drug czar in the history of this country. He came up through the FBI, was a close confidant of everybody's favorite villain, J. Edgar Hoover. And he was a guy who essentially invented the modern fight against drugs, what eventually becomes known as the war on drugs. And he does this in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, going into the 50s even. He finally retires when JFK forces him out in the early 60s. And then not long after that, 10 years later, Richard Nixon sort of picks up his work and gives it the name The War on Drugs. But Harry Anslinger is a open racist. And I don't mean this in the dog whistle way that a lot of people are open racist and are politicians today. Harry Anslinger is one of the only people ever censured on the floor of Congress for racism. That is how openly racist this man was. And the thing is, Harry Anslinger is the first person to, on a policy level, openly invent a sort of drug panic. And he does this for very selfish reasons. He was named the head of the anti-narcotics division right around the time that Prohibition ends. And he, of course, has a panic. He gets to this position he's worked his ass off to get to, and then the drug is the laws are repealed. And so what does Harry Anslinger do? But he starts whipping up this moral panic around other substances. He basically goes, look, that worked with Prohibition in terms of getting, you know, his group, which eventually becomes the DEA, funding to fight these, you know, bootleggers and all this kind of stuff. I know that if I find another target, I can do this again and continue doing this in perpetuity. So Harry chooses cannabis first. And he is the one that is really responsible for taking what at the time was sort of only, you know, degenerate smoke, you know, like kind of the way I guess we think about drinking too much or smoking menthol cigarettes. I don't know. But it was sort of a thing you weren't supposed to do. But Harry's the one that turns it into this panic, that reefer madness, right? That's Harry Anslinger. And to understand just how he was able to do this, look up some of his quotes. He is famous for the, amongst other things, telling people as a representative of the government that smoking cannabis leads directly to white women partying with jazz musicians and then, you know, sleeping with them and all. This was his rationale. Very open about all of this. It wasn't until later in life that he gets censured. I mean, it's a while before while he's talking for the government that this is all going on. But Harry is most famous for terrorizing one person in particular. Do you know where I'm going with this? Have you heard this story?
I'm a little familiar with it, but I can't remember.
So a recent movie came out that was about this, and it was based on a book called Chasing the Scream by Johann Hari. And Johann Hari did this incredible book about the war on drugs where he focused on three different segments. He embedded himself with drug sellers in, I think it was Baltimore, but don't quote me on that. Might have been DC, and also went overseas and researched it. But he spent a lot of the time talking about Anslinger and his terrorizing of Miss Lady Day herself. And she spent a lot of her life locked up and being terrorized by the U.S. government for basically just living her life and singing. She sang the song Strange Fruit, which really angered the U.S. government because it was about lynching and about all the horrible treatment that black people were experiencing in this country. But she was also struggling with addiction. And Harry Anslinger decided that he was going to publicly destroy her. Number one, I mean, just for being against racism, and he himself was an overt racist. But he does this by arresting her left and right for years. And the most famous story is she's in, and they show this in the movie, The United States versus Billie Holiday. Beautiful. The movie itself was only okay, but the story was told very well. She's on her deathbed. She's dying from addiction. And Harry Anslinger comes to the hospital to arrest her one last time and handcuffs her to the bed. And she dies while being under arrest by Harry Anslinger because he is trying to make an example of her in terms of why you shouldn't do drugs and all this. And in reality, as Johann puts so beautifully in this book and so many people have said since, it wasn't the drugs that killed Billie Holiday. It was prohibition. It was Harry Anslinger. So I encourage people, go read Chasing the Scream by Johann Hari. I think it's one of the best books in the war on drugs. But even more so, take some time to do a little research on Harry Anslinger. And the cherry on top of this is his policies that he pushed through, the anti-drug stuff, is the basis for our drug policies today. They were never repealed, even though he himself was censured, even though we now can look back and go, oh my God, what a horrible person who did all of this. His policies are still in place. And not only that, but Nixon builds off it. Reagan builds off it. Clinton builds off it. Obama, I mean, to today, our drug policy is built on Harry Anslinger's work. And even the people who are willing to say, of course, he was a terrible human being, we should not care about anything he did, are not willing to then go, and by the way, we should take a look at some of the drug laws that he pushed through. So when the whole foundation is built on overt racism, right, and nothing scientific in this, it's easy to understand why we have so many problems today.
Yeah, that's crazy. Yeah, I knew a little bit about the story on Billie Holiday because she's like one of my favorite artists and I love her, but her story is just so sad and so tragic. And yeah, like I'm definitely going to check that out, that book. So I know there's people out there who are probably listening or, not listening, I don't know, who are like, okay, they get it. This is, built off of racism and we really need to like look at our laws and policies again, but they might be, concerned with, well, like they don't want drugs to be easily accessible to, their kids or their loved ones. And they might be worried, like if we decriminalize drugs, for example, like what's that going to mean for people? And if we end the war on drugs, like how do we deal with that? So what would you tell those people?
Yeah, so I would say two things. Number one, the idea of a drug-free world is never going to happen. It's just not realistic. Even if we wanted that to be realistic, where do you start, right? I mean, does that mean you and I can't go have a drink tonight? Like, does that mean that if somebody wants to, you know, there are some places that still see caffeine as a drug, which it quite frankly is. Does that mean there's no coffee? Like, what does this literally mean? I have a friend who is so sober, it's like startling. She doesn't drink coffee, whatever. And she says that she wants to live in a world without drugs. And I say, where do you draw the line, right? I mean, sugar at high extent, I struggle with desires for sugar that mirror my desires when I was struggling with addiction, right? There are people who are, you know, workout addicts. There are people who are sex addicts. Does that mean we can't have sex or work out? Like, what does this literally mean to you? So let's throw that out the window first. That is not going to happen. It's also not possible. In fact, I would say a utopia society has all of the drugs. So get out of here with your views. The flip side of that is, how can we do it safely? And that is the question. There are two books that I would recommend. Beyond Chasing the Scream, which is a great historical book. But number one, it's called Drug Use for Grownups by a guy who is my absolute hero. His name is Carl Hart. He is the head of psychology, I believe it is, at Columbia. He is a open heroin user who is also the preeminent researcher in this country on drug use and drug users, and also, like I said, leads is a tenured professor and leads a division at Columbia. Brilliant human being. And he wrote a book called Drug Use for Grownups. He's written a couple. Drug Use for Grownups is the newest one, where he travels the world and is basically like, this is how this works other places. He can describe it better than I ever could. So please read Drug Use for Grownups. The other one is called Undoing Drugs by Maya Salovitz. Maya is also a wonderful journalist and writer. Has written for literally everybody. We would be here for the next hour if I was listing everyone she's ever written for. Written a couple of great books about, she's also in recovery and is also very open about her use of drugs. And she recently wrote this one called Undoing Drugs about the history of harm reduction in the United States and in the world, actually, and how we can implement harm reduction ideas to create a safer society for people who want to use drugs and are going to use drugs. Very briefly, because this could be a show in itself, I would say that there's two models or two applications that are already here that we can look at. The first one is alcohol. The second one is cannabis. Alcohol is not done well. If you actually step back and look at how we do alcohol, there are a lot of amazingly good parts of how we regulate and allow people to enjoy alcohol, namely what we can call safe consumption sites, right? What is a bar but a safe consumption site? You are able to go there. You know what is in your dose. We have safe supply of alcohol. Without it, you could go to a bar, you'd order a drink. Maybe it's a beer, maybe it's grain alcohol. You're not going to know until you drink it. That is what currently is happening with our drug market in other ways. So having safe supply in a safe consumption site and allowing people to buy at stores, I mean, that all about alcohol enjoyment and consumption is beautiful. Let's keep doing that. However, our alcohol laws are not really enforced the way they should be, right? I mean, in a better enforcement, we don't have drunk driving. We don't have children who are able to get their hands on alcohol because somebody's mother doesn't keep the liquor cabinet closed, right? So these are actual problems that would need to be addressed if we were going to allow for other drugs to be legalized, which I hope does happen in the future. The other flip side of that is cannabis, where the regulation is so strong that the studies are showing that we are doing a better job with the regulation or legalization of cannabis than we do with anything else, right? Forget your sensationalized headlines. We are seeing, just in places that have either legalized or allowed for medical cannabis, like what I have here in Pennsylvania, we are seeing significant drops in those in terms of auto accidents that are caused by people who are inebriated with cannabis at the time. We are seeing just incredible work being done that is reducing the access for people who are underage, because it's a lot harder to get their hands on it if it is well regulated. And what I would suggest to people who are concerned with how rolling out legalized drug use would work, look at places that have completely legalized cannabis, because it is being done exceptionally well. Are there problems? Of course there are. You know, you hear horror stories of the parent who accidentally left their gummies out and the kid gets super high. The difference is, he's not going to die. He's going to have a terrible day or two. Don't get me wrong. I mean, when I've been to like that high, it's not fun. But you can't overdose on cannabis. It's literally not possible. To actually overdose on cannabis, you would actually be overdosing on the other things around it, whether you were smoking. And they've done the math. It's like literally 100,000 joints or something like that. It's ridiculous. So let's look at cannabis as a good example, and mix what we're doing right with cannabis and what we've done well with alcohol, and learning from our mistakes with alcohol as well to allow for a better regulated system of sale and consumption for drug use.
I lost my train of thought. What was I saying?
I was just that good that I blew your mind and you're like, oh my God, like I've never thought about it that way. Cause thank you. You're welcome.
Yeah. It's all really good stuff and all like new things that like I said before, like, you know, I don't really know a lot of people to talk about this, and I think people need to learn about, especially people who are so anti-drug. And yeah, like what you said, drugs aren't going to go away. People who are anti-drugs probably have Tylenol in their cabinet.
That's right.
Or probably have like, you know, cold medicine or something. And probably give their kids like children's Robitussin or something. Those are all drugs. You know, they exist everywhere and they all serve a certain purpose. And, you know, we can't necessarily eliminate these things. You know, like some people survive off of the medication that they're on, and without it, you know, they wouldn't be with us right now.
That's right. And the thing that is a drug to you is a lifesaver to me, and vice versa, right? So the idea of eliminating it is just, it's, we have to get rid of this idea because it doesn't make any sense. It's like trying to say we should eliminate the sun because it gives people sunburns. Okay, go sit in the corner.
Yeah. Yeah. And then like, also I know people have the argument too, like they're decriminalizing it or whatever welcomes like the cartel and the black market. And like, sorry to say, but they're already here. But in my opinion, I think if we legalize drugs, it would essentially eliminate the need for the cartel and
that's
the
right.
black market, because then it's accessible to people. And I think if people who live in a world who don't think that drugs are easily acceptable, I'm pretty sure I could probably go down the street and get whatever drug I want. I'm sure there's a drug dealer somewhere around here.
Well, not only that, so two things, because you just raised a really important point that we haven't talked about. There is a lot of violence in the drug trade. I mean, we can't shy away from that, right? And you brought up the cartels, which is a great point. Obviously, what we've heard out of Mexico the last couple of years is scary and is very sad. What I would suggest is, when is the last time that you heard Johnson & Johnson murdering a competitor? Right? When is the last time that Walgreens went across the street and shot out CVS? It does not happen. I am not a huge fan of just sort of blanket capitalism. I think that a lot of the issues we're seeing around us can be drawn to that. However, a regulated market in theory and in some of the practices that we see is actually done well. And, you know, the fact that CVS and Walgreens are not killing each other is examples of this. So, you know, the studies have shown that a lot of the problems can be traced direct. Those sorts of violence problems can be traced to prohibition, because if things are legal, you don't have this dangerous fighting over these issues, right? People can actually do things like, oh, I don't know, take someone to court or settle these things in arbitration instead of shooting out their competitors. Because if you don't have a legal recourse, you have to operate outside of the law. And that's what we're seeing with a lot of these cartels. So that point, I think, is a really important one. The other one is sort of hammering home what we were talking about before. When I was at my worst, and I wrote about this in an article for Yes Magazine that dropped about 6 weeks ago. When I was at my worst, I was addicted to and taking just so many pills every day that were very harmful to me. And yet they were prescribed by a doctor and I was getting them from CVS. CVS was my drug dealer. The thing that was helping me live every day, the thing that was keeping me alive and feeling better because I was nauseous, because I felt horrible in my own skin, was cannabis. And I was buying that from a guy behind an apartment complex down the street, right? At the time, people were telling me left and right the issue was cannabis. I had to get off of cannabis. And in reality, that was the thing keeping me alive. So I can tell you from my own experience that your thinking on this is incorrect. Not you personally. I mean, person listening. No, person listening. Your thinking on this is incorrect. And there are very few topics that we allow people with no knowledge to actually have their opinion mean something, right? I do this all the time. Clearly, I know what I'm talking about. I do this all the time. I have both lived and learned experience on this. And I can't tell you how many times I'll be talking to a person and I'll tell them all this kind of stuff. And they'll go, yeah, I just still think heroin should be illegal. And my response to that is, I don't really care what you think. You don't have lived experience. You have no knowledge on this. Why should I, like, no offense, but quite frankly, why should I care? You know, it'd be a lot like allowing someone to walk into an operating room and be like, do they really need all those drugs? Like, who are you? Get out of here. We don't need to listen to you right now. But the problem is we live in a country where everyone's voice is doesn't mean everything, right? There are sadly so many issues where you and me just don't have a voice, you know, and we're seeing that right now, especially at the Supreme Court. But when it comes to these discussions, we have politicians going, yeah, but those people over there are saying that I should still vote to keep drugs illegal. It's like, I don't care about those people over there, right? If all the scientists in the room, if all the people who have lived experience are saying, do this, and Sally, Jesse, you know, mother over there who has no experience with drugs and only knows what she learned in DARE is telling you the opposite, I don't really care what she says. I don't think anyone should. So I wish that drugs were not a topic that we just allowed anybody to have an opinion on, because most people's opinions are wrong.
Yeah, I completely agree, because that's why I really wanted to talk to you about and bring someone on and not just me talking about, because I, you know, didn't struggle with like substance misuse. But I do know people who have, and I know it's an important thing to talk about. And I know people who have been incarcerated for like just having possession of marijuana. But like, you make a really great point, because it reminds me of like during the whole elections and how they're having like famous people endorse, you know, these different presidents. And I'm like, you live a different world from right. The rest of us. Yeah. You are like multimillionaires, billionaires. You don't have the same struggles that we do. You don't pay the same types of taxes we do. Like, why should I care about who you think should be the next president?
Right. It always makes me think back, and you might be a little young for this reference, but it's fine. During 9/11, right after 9/11, and Dave Chappelle did a whole, before Dave Chappelle went off the deep end and became an awful human being, he did a whole thing on this, where was it CNN or one of the channels, for some reason, decided to bring Ja Rule on to give his opinion on 9/11. And to this day, it is a punchline of, you know, something horrible will happen and you'll get on Twitter and at least somebody will go viral for tweeting, but what does Ja Rule think about this, right? And yet that is the society we live in. I don't care what Ja Rule thinks about this. You know, to your point, when somebody endorses, you know, Cardi B says, I'm going to vote for this person. Cardi, I love your music. I don't care at all who you're going to vote for in the next election. I don't care at all what you think about this issue, unless I agree with it. And then I'm going to trumpet Cardi B for having a good idea. But we give people so many, we fail to separate opinion from fact. And that is, we're seeing that obviously at a grand scale right now in our country. But when it comes to some of these really important issues, we have to be willing to say, I'm so sorry if you don't feel heard, but you have no basis for this opinion. You have no lived experience. You have no learned experience. We're going to not really care about your opinion.
Yeah. So thank you for talking about, I feel like we can just, you know, go on forever. I know we've, it's like been over an hour. But I wanted to like, you know, give you a little more time also to like talk about, is there something last, well, first of all, is there one last thing you want to share with the audience and also where that they can find you?
Well, let me say this, that, I spent 10 months producing a documentary podcast series on a lot of these topics. And specifically, it's educating on addiction, mental health, substance misuse, all that, and drug policy and the history of the war on drugs. I mean, I touch on all of it through one person's story. And her name is Sarah Laurel. She's a friend of mine here in Philadelphia. She runs an organization called Savage Sisters that is, she started from her hospital bed after being thrown out the second story window of a trap house while struggling with addiction. And she is, this organization that she started, she's amazing. This organization does harm reduction outreach and recovery housing and is really making a difference here in Philadelphia. And obviously I'm biased because I created the thing, but I think does a really good job of educating on this, but also helping people see one person from life to today, how addiction sort of was a response to trauma, and then trauma was a response to it. Like it just really helps people understand that this is not as cut and dry as the way that we think about this stuff. So what I would suggest to people is if you care about these topics, and I hope that you do, go listen to this podcast series, 10 episodes, roughly 7 or so hours total, 8 hours, called Choose Your Struggle Presents Made It Season 1 Stay Savage. You can find it by searching wherever you listen to this podcast. Search for Choose Your Struggle. You'll see my weekly show, which is currently on hiatus. That cover is me as Han Solo. Don't worry about that. I mean, you can go listen to that, the old episodes of that if you want. I appreciate it. But the other one, Choose Your Struggle Presents Made It Season 1 Stay Savage, the cover is my friend Sarah as a highlight in a purple background. Check that out. I think it's worth your time. And then reach out and let me know what you thought, if it changed the way you thought about addiction or drug use or drug users. You can find me at jayshiffman.com, jayshiffman.com, chooseyourstruggle.com. I'm Jay Schiffman, or Choose Your Struggle on every social media. Would definitely love to hear from you.
Thanks for making it to the end. If you enjoy what you hear and want to stay up to date on the show, please follow me on Facebook and or on Instagram. You can also check out my website at thetalkativeintrovertpodcast.com. All the information will be on there as well as in the show notes. If you want to help support the show, please review and rate the podcast and share it with your friends and family. Thanks so much, and I'll talk to you guys in the next episode.